Hi, everybody. I'm Scott.
Hello, I'm Julie.
And this is A Good Story is Hard to Find podcast,
where two Catholic friends talk about the books and movies they love and the traces of the one reality that lie below the surface.
Yeah, and this is episode number 109. And we're going to talk about an optimistic movie that just leaves me so happy. It's called Double Indemnity, directed by Billy Wilder.
I don't think I can actually believe a word you said.
1944, no less.
Oh, well, that I can believe.
All right. Well, luckily, we have someone here that will straighten out my view of the movie, which I did love, by the way. Don't get me wrong. It's just not very optimistic.
Right.
Rose Davis, hello.
Hi.
Welcome.
Thank you.
I was so excited to hear you were coming on, because you know some cool stuff about Billy Wilder.
Yeah, I actually did an homage film to Billy Wilder when I was in college.
Oh, I love it.
That was my freshman year final project.
Was it a piece of film noir?
It was, yeah. My paper was on him as like a director who crosses genres, but the film was noir.
Oh, how cool. How cool. And what would you say is noir? I guess it's a tough definition, or is it tough?
Well, the visual look, I mean, film noir is typically based off of hard-boiled crime novels. But the term film noir comes from the lighting they used, which has a lot of shadows. Partially that's because it was cheap to have fewer lights, so those films could be made more cheaply, but it became like its defining look.
Really? Oh, that's interesting. And is this one of the earliest ones that they would call film noir, kind of the something that started the real definition of what that is?
Yeah, I mean, it's one of the biggest ones and one of the most influential ones.
But don't you think film noir started, well, I guess I'm thinking of Edward G. Robinson, and those were more gangster movies.
And I think it did stem from gangster movies. But I think can find examples of film noir in the 30s.
Yeah, and this is 44. So I think because it was done from a James M. Cain, if I'm right about that, novel that was written about 8 years before. And the thing I liked about him is I remember one of his novels came out recently, a found novel, and they were going to publish it. And somebody was saying that it was a bit tawdry and all that kind of thing. And somebody pulled up a famous quote from some other novelist of that sort, like Raymond Chandler or somebody like that, who said, he always had a bit of the Billy Goat, a whiff of Billy Goat about him. And I was like, oh. And I was thinking about it in terms of this movie, and we'll have to do a quick summary, but the first time Fred McMurray sees Barbara Stanwyck, he didn't care about anything except, how can I get that staircase out from between me and that pair of legs? And you're just like, oh, Lord, have mercy, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
He's on the make, there's no doubt.
That's cool. I was looking up James M. Cain. Didn't he do, or didn't he write, The Postman Always Rings Twice? Yeah, there it is.
I think so.
Yeah, based on a novel by, interesting. Gosh, connections everywhere.
Him?
No, I have not read anything by him, but I've seen The Postman Always Rings Twice. Which I don't know, would you call that noir?
I think the movie was.
I think so.
But it just goes to show that Hollywood has been stealing ideas for its history, its entire history.
Yeah, yeah. Wow. Well, cool. So, yeah, it's interesting that this was released in 1944. I find that interesting because, you know, clearly World War II was in full force at that time. So Hollywood must have been a very interesting place right then. So it was released go ahead.
I was just going to say also because then you had the studio system. So it's not like now where any star could be in any movie they wanted. You had all this bargaining going on at the same time as dealing with whatever World War II was throwing at you.
Well, and Billy Wilder had actually just come off doing a war movie.
Oh, he did do some of that.
Yeah, and this is really early in his career too, from what I can tell. It's like
I think the third movie he directed. But he was a writer before that.
Okay.
Yeah,
he left. Before this, he did. Yeah, before this, he did Five Graves to Cairo, which was a war movie. The patriotic bent.
But he also started in Germany, where he grew up. He left because of Hitler, when Hitler was coming to power. So he was working in movies there. He might not have been directing. But he'd been working in movies since like the 1930, maybe? Something like that?
Yeah, he was writing. He started out as a journalist. He started writing for movies. He either directed a movie there or in Paris, vowed he'd never do it again. But he kept writing. When he left Berlin, he went to Paris because French was the other language he could speak. He wasn't getting enough work there as a writer. But one of his ideas got bought by Hollywood. And Hollywood provided a one-way ticket and a worker's visa that lasted a few weeks. So he decided he'd go out to Hollywood. He didn't speak any English.
Wow.
And he wound up, writing for Paramount.
Oh, okay.
How cool. I love that story. That's neat.
Good for him. Down the block from where you work, Rose.
Yes.
Yes.
Just down the road.
Yeah.
Cool. All right. So, yeah, the movie's put together interestingly. So it opens with, you know, I liked in the credits where they, you know, you don't really know when you watch it for the first time, but the silhouette of the guy with the crutches, and then it says Double Indemnity.
Right.
That was really pretty cool.
Yeah.
And, you know, it opens with Fred McMurray's character zipping through L.A. in his car. You don't know it's him at first, but he's running red lights and things, and he gets to his office building, and you could tell that he's hurt, and then he starts to talk into a cylinder recorder.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And
I was thinking dictaphone, but yeah.
Yeah, that could be what it's called. I can't remember what they're called, but it was a wax cylinder, right, that he was recording his voice onto. And he starts talking to this guy, Keys. You know, when he walked, or he arrived there and got on the elevator, there was something there that I thought was pretty cool. Sorry, it took me a second to look at it. the guy who's running the elevator, so there's a guy who drives the elevator. They don't let just anyone drive the elevator. So he's there, and he's an older guy, and he says, "How's the insurance business?" And Fred McMurray said, "It's okay." And then he said, "They wouldn't ever sell me any. They say I have something loose in my heart."
Oh, right.
Ha ha, I say it's rheumatism. But I thought that was a really cool line. I liked it because clearly he did not have something loose in his heart. It was the other guy.
Wow.
I just thought it was neat.
I didn't even.
Yeah.
Good one. I did not get that.
But yeah, well, so yeah, he just brings him up to his office, and then that's when he starts to tell the story of what got him to where he is now.
Yeah, it's all flashback.
It's all flashback, yeah.
And heart is interesting. That's an interesting point that it starts with heart, because it ends with that too. I mean, not the same line, but the movie is so funny because Fred McMurray's character is the fulcrum on which everything depends. And I was thinking about the name Double Indemnity and the fact that, you know, I was thinking about Double, and I was like, he's connected to Barbara Stanwyck's character. He's connected to, I can't remember his first name, Keys, Edward G. Robinson's character. And he's such a weak link for everybody. He's terribly weak. And so to have something loose in his heart that really kind of ties into his whole character, that's brilliant.
Yeah, you realize that right away. You know, and it's interesting that he's telling the story to himself too. But he keeps saying, you know, well, I'm not whitewashing anything. I'm telling you exactly what happened. I'm telling it how it is. And he's not kind to himself, even though he's telling the story.
Oh, and there's some amazing lines in here.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, so he ends up going to, you know, now we're in flashback. He ends up going to this lady's house because he needs to renew her husband's insurance. And the moment they meet, then everything changes. He likes her anklet.
Well, yeah, and what it's amazing how well that scene defines both those characters, because she is, the maid is there who's let him in, and he's just kind of lounging in the door, and he sees her and straightens right up, and he's like, oh yeah, and he knows this is the wife. He doesn't even give that a second thought, you can see. And she is wrapped in a towel, and for all you know, there's nothing on under there. And she's standing at the top of the stairs talking to a stranger. And you're just like, oh my gosh, these are both very loose, sleazy, you know, put a label on it people from the beginning. And they both, there's a spark. You can see it. They're both interested for various reasons in each other.
Right. Yeah. You think at first anyway that it's about each other.
Yeah, well.
Which is cast completely into doubt later. I'm trying to remember. He would have introduced himself pretty quickly as an insurance salesman. I'm trying to remember the exact words. But you start to think, well, how early does she formulate plans? You know, how quickly does she do that?
I just think she's one of those people who is always thinking and looking for the little opportunity. Mm-hmm. And how she can use people. Oh, go ahead.
I think the earliest you know is when she asks what type of insurance he sells.
Right.
He lists off a bunch, and then she asks, what about accident insurance?
Right, and she does that the second meeting, right? It's not the first one.
Yeah, because that's when she brings up how dangerous her husband's job is.
Right, exactly.
Yes.
So she thinks about it a while. And
right.
But yet she's got something going on in her head because she asked him to come back in that first meeting.
Mm-hmm.
And it couldn't have been about the car insurance.
No, and that's when they have one of these lightning exchanges of dialogue where he's been talking about her anklet and being a bit pushy. And she's like, there's a speed limit in this state, Mr. Knapp. Says, oh, what is it? 45 miles an hour. How fast was I going? I'd say about 90. And they just keep going and going and going. And I can't remember the thing about, you know, I wonder what you mean. And he says, I wonder if you wonder.
Yeah, I mean, yeah.
They're having a great time, but at the same time, they're showing how well they understand each other, too.
That's true, yeah. And they do. They do understand each other quickly.
Yeah.
But in that, in that second meeting, Walter Neff's first reaction is no, right? Even though, you know, it seems like he has a moment where he realizes what she's getting at, and it is really the moment when she asks him about accident insurance, and he says something about, well, once you get accident insurance, you know, you might help him have an accident. And get
yeah,
paid.
He's like, I know what you're thinking.
And then he let himself out. He said, I'm leaving. You know, I'm glad I'm not your husband. How did he put that?
But he didn't say that it was the wrong thing to do. He said that she would get caught.
That's right. You're right.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah. He says, yeah, you always get caught. You don't know who. Yeah, he's thinking about keys. But he says, you know, there are people there that are going to figure this out. You're never gonna do it.
Yeah, because you've met, I can't remember if you meet him right before that second meeting, you must have, but anyway, very soon you meet his boss, who is played by Edward G. Robinson Keys, and his job is
his boss, but the investigator.
Right. Okay. Well, you're right. He's the insurance investigator. He's the claims investigator. And he says, I have a little man inside. Sometimes this little man won't let me eat or sleep or anything else because he always has this instinctive understanding of when something doesn't add up. Because when I listen to that little man, it's never wrong. I just have to find out where's the logical flaw. And he wants Walter to join him and be an insurance investigator. And Walter, I thought that this was such a telling scene. Walter's like, he's already kind of committed to Barbara Stanwyck at that point, but he's like, I wouldn't make as much money. He's like, no, but you'd be really good at this, and you'd be, it'd be interesting and all these things. And he's like, yeah. And you know he's already a good salesman. And I'm thinking, oh, yeah, so he's lazy. He's greedy. He is ready for any easy opportunity that comes along, as we know from his first reaction to Barbara Stanwyck. I mean, he's got so many flaws in his character, and they're all shown right there. But Keyes' little man doesn't see that because Keyes loves him like a son.
Yeah. Yeah. He vouches for him later.
Well, yeah. And Walter loves him too.
Yeah. He certainly has a great deal of respect for him.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Keeps calling him Keyes. You know, I don't know how close
they were. Yeah, he always lights a cigarette and Keyes can never find his match.
Right. And Keyes will say something sharp to him that shows that he cares one way or the other. And he'll always go, I love you too. I love you too, Keyes. So they understand each other on a deeper level.
That's right. So just back to the writing really quickly. Is there, can you tell like what Chandler did and what Billy Wilder did? I heard that there was, I read somewhere that they argued about stuff. Is that right? Okay, well, you're laughing. I assume that's right.
Okay, so Billy Wilder and Raymond Chandler wrote this together. Billy Wilder's normal writing partner was Charles Brackett, who, so brief history on film, I guess. During this time, there was something called the Hays Code, right, which was the censorship code that Hollywood enforced on itself through the William Hays office. William Hays wrote a code. The Hays Code was enforced by the censorship office. This book would have been made into a movie long before it was, except that the censorship code was like, no, you can't do it. You can't show two people planning and executing a murder. It's immoral. We're never going to approve it. And Charles Brackett apparently agreed, because he refused to work on it. So Billy Wilder needed a writing partner to write the kind of tough talk that noir films had. So he read some Black Mask stories.
Oh, I didn't know that's where he found them.
Yeah, and discovered Raymond Chandler, who he liked a lot. He'd already published a few of his novels as well. He did The Big Sleep and Farewell, My Lovely. I think he was just about to publish Lady in the Lake.
Mm.
So he decided to work with Raymond Chandler, who knew nothing about screenwriting. And they didn't get along at all. They worked together for months, and they never got along. And it was past the point of just not getting along to they like actually hated each other.
Wow.
Billy Wilder was morally loose. His marriage was falling apart. He would get women calling him a lot during the day, and he believed that drinking should start at 4 o'clock. Raymond Chandler was faithfully married and a recovering alcoholic.
Oh, wow.
So he found everything he did obnoxious. And he was frustrated by the fact that Billy Wilder knew all of this stuff about screenwriting that he didn't know. Raymond Chandler, on the other hand, threatened to quit at least once a week, would complain about Billy Wilder to the producers with lists of things that were like, he asked me to close the Venetian blinds because the sun was coming in and he never said please. But Raymond Chandler was the one who said that they needed to change the dialogue from the way it was written in the novel. Because what was written for the novel was written for your eye, not for your ear.
Oh, okay.
And Billy Wilder did not want to. He wanted to lift the dialogue from the book. He actually brought in actors to perform the dialogue.
Really?
And Raymond Chandler still said no. So then he brought in the author of the novel, who agreed with Raymond Chandler.
How frustrating.
Holy cow. So this was wild.
Yeah. So they definitely worked together, but it wasn't a happy partnership. However, I don't think that comes through really.
No, I thought it was just curious to me, you know, who had the influence on, you know, the snappy dialogue and things. Yeah. And it sounds like it was, well, yeah, it was Chandler. Chandler got his way then, it sounds like, right?
Well,
he got dialogue that's not lifted.
However, Billy Wilder was a snappy writer.
Yeah. Think of Sunset Boulevard and Some Like It Hot and, oh my gosh, he had so many movies that are so great.
Yeah.
Well, also, though, I just want to throw in one thing that Rose politely didn't say. Billy Wilder drove this project, drove Raymond Chandler back to alcohol.
Oh, yeah.
Did it really?
Billy Wilder always said that was his revenge for having to work with Raymond Chandler, was that he drove him back to drink.
Holy cow.
No.
That's horrible.
Raymond Chandler complained he was never invited to his own movie premiere. Billy Wilder would always say, well, of course we didn't. He was drunk under the table at Lucy's.
So.
Wow.
They never made it up, I guess. Man. Well, and amazing. Part of the other problem, I think, Rose, that you were mentioning was that Raymond Chandler wanted to write in the way you would a novel, all the scenes and the screen angles and the director's directions. And that's just not how a screenplay is done either. So they had a lot of tangling over that kind of thing too.
Yeah.
He just wasn't a professional at that. So.
So early, early scripts didn't include that kind of direction.
Modern scripts don't either.
They still don't.
They're not supposed to. You'll find some that do, but those tend to be things, scripts that are written by people that are going to direct them. Like if you read Coen Brothers scripts, they'll include a lot of that, or Tarantino scripts. But for the most part, it's considered bad form to write in camera direction.
Okay. I've read a couple of Harlan Ellison scripts and they all have that in there.
Maybe that's why everybody works.
It could also depend on whether you're reading a shooting draft.
Uh-huh, yeah.
Those are different.
Okay.
Than the early drafts that the screenwriters finish.
Wow, this is cool.
But for the most part, that stuff is not included at all.
Okay. Fascinating. I'm learning a lot. This is cool.
So, yeah, I guess that leaves the actors and the directors more open to how they interpret what the screenplay is itself.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't have anything about she started off at the head of the staircase. Billy Wilder is imagining that as he's reading the script or whatever.
So how Rose. About the actors? Did he get who he thought he wanted or was there haggling over that?
Well, he did. Barbara Stanwyck and Fred McMurray, who played the two main characters, this was not a typical role for them. Fred McMurray was actually known for playing all-American, likable heroes, and he was working for another studio at the time.
Hmm.
But Billy Wilder pestered him day after day after day until he finally said yes, because he assumed that the studio he was working for would turn him down ultimately. but he'd been playing hardball in contract negotiations and his contract was almost up. So the studio was like, well, we'll just let him sink with this and then we'll renegotiate contracts. So they allowed him to do it.
Huh. Wow.
Okay. It wound up not being the lesson they thought it was going to be.
So it was a big success at the time, was it?
Oh, yeah, it was huge.
Okay, cool.
Well, and I think it's probably, I mean, I haven't seen Fred McMurray in tons of movies, but I remember My Three Sons, which was when I was a kid, was in its last legs. And he was, you know, Mr. Nice Guy. Or what was the Disney movie about the absent-minded professor or whatever?
Oh, yeah.
He was in that. He was always the nice guy. And even for me, when I discovered Double Indemnity, it was such a shock to see him so effectively playing so against type. I mean, he showed what kind of an actor he could be in this, or Billy Wilder showed what kind of a director he was. I guess he saw it in him. And Barbara Stanwyck, same way. I watched Big Valley. I don't know if you ever came across that, Scott, but, you know, she was the tough-minded but fair and wonderful matriarch of the farming family in California in the Big Valley, and so, or the ranch family. And so I saw her doing this slinky femme fatale thing, and it was like, what? And didn't they dye her hair blonde for that?
It was a wig. Okay. But he wanted to get the trashiest hair color possible. So the wig itself is actually like a white blonde that was as light as they could get.
It's pretty awful looking. It's pretty terrible. Well, and so she always played good guys. And so she was cast against type, but she didn't fight it as much, I guess.
And then she showed some hesitation, but she was more willing because he was a director who's getting a name for himself.
And then Edward G. Robinson didn't want to do it because he wouldn't be the star. Right? And so, but he wound up being the star, but he just wasn't the name star, essentially. But he was the heart of the movie, really.
Yeah, he was fantastic.
Yeah, and his relationship with the main character is a little different from what was in the book. When they were writing the screenplay, they felt that there wasn't really a relationship that centered the character. Because obviously Barbara Stanwyck is the worst and his daughter or his relationship with her stepdaughter, had to remain innocent. So they changed, in the novel, Edward G. Robinson's character Keyes is more just like the moral compass. But they changed it to be like a more emotional relationship between them to try and give some, you know, emotional focus for the protagonist, which I think they completely got. It really is the emotional center of the film.
Yeah, I agree with that. Yeah, it definitely worked.
Yeah, and you, yeah, because you see the tragedy of what could have been if he'd have chosen differently. And I guess we're way far away from any summary of anything.
No, this is fascinating. Yeah, we're now we need to get back to
the summary. They decide to get double indemnity insurance and make a plot to kill her husband, and then we start to see it unravel.
Yeah, and that was the thing, you know. So yeah, he stormed out of there, and after that second meeting, and then she came to his house or his apartment, and he had been thinking about it, and it was him who said, all right, we're going to do this, you know, and then it was even later on that he talked about doing double indemnity and it had to be on a train. Right. So, yeah, so, I mean, he fell way, way off.
Quickly.
Yeah, very quickly.
But did you notice, speaking of the Hays Code, that's one of my favorite things in that movie is he's like, okay, baby, we're going to do it. Because I love that they talk like that. All right, baby. And she's like, oh, okay, Walter. And then she's kissing him. And then scene fade. And the next thing you see, he's sitting there on the couch smoking a cigarette and she's putting her lipstick back on. And the lighting is different and everything. And you're just like, oh, I know what happened. I know what you guys did, by the way, how you sealed the deal. Like you didn't have to show anything.
Yeah.
It was wonderfully done.
Yeah, that's interesting. So this really pushed the envelope, didn't it?
He always did.
Wilder well, always did?
Yeah.
Okay. That's neat.
He was very European in his sensibilities, obviously, and he would push as far as he could for the Hays Code because he felt that if he wanted to have a prostitute in his film, he should be able to have one, whereas the Hays Code frowned upon such things.
Are you thinking of, like, Irma LaDuce?
I guess that was one. He had another one in a different film. But also the subjects he chose.
Right.
Like this. Cold-blooded. And then he did The Lost Weekend, which is about alcoholism.
Yes.
He chose subjects that were going to be controversial for the Hays Code. He was always pushing the envelope.
Well, and even in, not so much, I guess, maybe, but even in his funny movies, he was always flirting with stuff where you kind of were raising an eyebrow. And I assume at the time, like, you know, some like it hot. You cannot find a funnier movie, but it has two guys in drag for most of the movie. And that allows them into where all these young girls are all the time. Marilyn Monroe is not a straight-laced character. She is hilariously innocent, so she can get away with it. But the stuff she's willing to do, you know, everybody takes for granted.
Yeah, and one of the dresses she's wearing is so sheer that the only reason they got it past the censors is the way they lit it.
Yes.
No kidding.
And
wow.
You can tell. You can't tell where her skin stops and the dress begins. I mean, it's amazing. And then even something that's from, I think, a little bit later, like Love in the Afternoon, which is Gary Cooper and Audrey Hepburn. I mean, I know their actual ages were closer than they looked because she always looked very young and he always looked more craggy. But it's like you're looking at a teenage girl and an old, much older man, and this flirtation they're carrying on. He is determined not to just flirt, and she's almost determined to let him. Let's go. And you're just like, no, 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 you're way too young. No. I know some things aren't thought about then the way they are now, but I still feel like some of those things were really pushing the envelope on even just innocently like that.
Well, and also things like adultery in Love in the Afternoon, a lot of the affairs he's having with...
I completely forgot. Her father is a detective who's been asked to investigate him, and he's got a huge file on him because so many husbands have asked him to be investigated because he's constantly playing with wives. Now, they're in Paris, so it's looked at a little more leniently, but the movie was made for America. Hmm. Yeah.
Wow. Well, I've got several movies to watch.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely.
Really, when you look at the fact that he's like, okay, baby, I have it all planned. And instead of being, as we find out later, the way she kind of took advantage of opportunities that would come up and exploit those for her own benefit, his plan seems good. But you know how it is. You can never think of everything. And that's when you just go, oh, and he's a little stupid too.
Because he tells him that through the whole thing, he talks about how there is no perfect murder.
Keys, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know why he thinks he can get away with it, but he trusts her so quickly.
Yeah, that's something I was going to say. There was an interesting couple of exchanges between Neff and Phyllis where he's telling her things that she already knows. That makes me think that he doesn't trust her even at that point. You know, is he just mansplaining or whatever? But, you know, she says, I know that already. And he's saying, well, we're going to do this, we're going to do that. You know, and they're like in the grocery store. And she says, I know. And he says, now don't do that and don't do this.
I just think that shows he's so nervous and such a novice that he's worried and going over the details again.
And she's she's the calm one who's
right.
Like, right. Yeah, I got it. Whatever.
Well, yeah, and he has a great line about after the murder occurs, and he's worried that she's going to crack up about it. And he's like, no, she did everything perfectly. It was like she behaved beautifully. And it's like, well, yeah, because this is obviously exactly what she wants. But
well, and it's also he says that, and I think it's after – you've seen them driving through that dark spot where she's hit her horn twice and you don't see what he's doing to the husband in the seat, but what you do see is her face and that's all it shows. And she doesn't even look upset or shocked or like she just has this little cat who ate the cream smile on her face. And it's not a big one. It's very subtle, but she's very happy about the whole situation.
Yeah.
You know. Most people would have a rush of adrenaline for some reason. You know, somebody's being killed right next to you. But she is cool as a cucumber.
Yeah, and I don't remember where it is in the movie, but there's that conversation where Neff asks Keys why he never married.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, well, I almost got married once. And then, you know, that little man and he spoke up and I had her investigated. And I found out she's been dyeing her hair since she was 16. There was a manic depressive in the family. She had a husband. know, he cuts her off when he starts talking about her brother, but it's all these things that are obviously also about Barbara Stanwyck.
Right.
Her hair is horribly dyed. She has a husband and he's having an affair with her anyway. I mean, she's, you know, emotionally unbalanced.
Yeah.
And he just ignores it.
Oh, yeah, exactly. Well, and it's kind of that thing of, since just to delve a touch into the Catholic thing, because the reason that the Hays Code people were wrong not to want to show this, unless I guess you got the right script, in which case they allowed it, is it shows all the reasons you want to listen to that little man. I mean, you don't want to listen. When we are tempted to do something wrong for whatever reason, we're just shoving all those things, just like Walter Neff. Oh, yeah, yeah, that's different. I'm different. Yeah, you can't have a perfect murder, but I've got this figured out. I mean, how many excuses do we make for ourselves? We are Walter. You know, I look at him and I go, he's a little stupid. And I'm like, oh, and how many times am I a little stupid? You know, I'm just doing something like going, I think if I eat this chocolate bar standing up out of the cupboard, it's my body won't notice, you know?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and he blames it on fate.
Right.
He says, oh, I think the fates aren't going to let it happen. Oh, never mind, they did. Like, he doesn't have a choice in it anymore.
Yeah.
And how many times do we do that? Oh, well, it was fate.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I couldn't avoid it. It had to happen.
Yeah.
Things were already in motion. I couldn't go back from it. Mm-hmm. You know, every excuse we all use is the excuse he had. And it's funny, because knowing that the Hays Code people were so angry about it, it is such a moral movie.
Yeah.
It really is. Yeah, because immediately following the deed, well, first of all, that scene with the where they can't start the car.
Oh, that was great.
That was really something. Yeah.
Yeah.
Because that would have screwed things up.
Yeah, and I know that that Fred McMurray wanted to play it shorter. He kept trying to do it faster and faster. But Billy Wilder kept telling him to slow it down. He said, it's about the suspense.
Uh-huh. Yeah, yeah.
And you feel it.
Oh, yeah.
You feel that tension.
Yeah, and it's weird as a movie watcher to be like, start that car. Come on, car. Start. You know, these guys just did something horrible. Yeah. And I'm just like, oh, start the car.
Exactly. And I guess it's helped a bit because the guy himself that they kill, you're never sympathetic with him. He's always gruff. Hmm. He, you know, the wife is, of course, lying, but she's like, oh, he hits me or he pushes me around.
That is an interesting choice. And you never know if she was telling the truth about that. You knew he was gruff.
No.
But you never knew if he was really like that.
Yeah, exactly. And so what you have there, though, is the conscience that touches him. It's funny because he's Fred McMurray, Walter Neff. He's got two different chances to change things. One is Keyes, who he's known all along, and he wants to ignore him. But the one he can't ignore is Lola, the daughter, which, what a funny name, because, you know, that's like a showgirl name. And here's this innocent young thing. But she is going to suffer also. And because she's innocently going to suffer, he can't say, oh, that's just how Keyes always talks. Oh, the insurance company has lots of money. It's the voice that he has to listen to.
There's also, I mean, very shortly after that, he has the feeling that things are going to go terribly wrong. So it's his own inner guy or whatever. Yes.
Yeah.
He said, you know, I did it perfectly. Like, everything was great. I didn't overlook anything. And yet, what did he say? It sounds crazy, Keyes, but it's true. So help me. I couldn't hear my own footsteps. It was the walk of a dead man.
Yeah, that's it.
Right.
One of the things I loved is how they would repeat certain things in the dialogue in this movie. Of course, and they would plan it that way. You know, one of the lines that's so big, you and me, I'll take down mine. And then later, Keith said it, because he says, oh, no two people can commit murder, because they, you know, they get on that trolley and they go straight down the line to the cemetery. And you could see Walter go, what? What did you say? Straight down the line? No, that's the thing. And then every time she says it to him, that's just reinforcing what Keith said. You know, it's a brilliant little way to just kind of poke it. And it's almost that way where, you know, the again, the little things that we like to ignore. How many signs do you get given? Stop it.
Hmm. Yeah. So Phyllis, he found out, Walter Neff found out that she was seeing someone who he thought was seeing her stepdaughter. And when that happened, he realized that maybe the whole thing had been a lie, or the whole thing, he had been played the whole time. That was quite a moment.
And yeah. Nino is always seems fishy.
Yeah.
Because for one thing, he's named Nino. It makes him a suspicious foreign sounding person.
Yeah, yes. Yeah. Nino Zacchetti.
He's kind of flashy looking too. We've seen him when he drops Walter drops Lola off to meet him clandestinely, and he looks kind of flashy. He's not too friendly.
And he's upset. Mm-hmm. And Neff is like, "Hey, I just gave her a ride. Is there any reason to get upset?" In the way that he spoke. That surprised me that she was seeing him. I didn't catch that. You know, I didn't see that coming.
Well, also, it's you kind of wonder if she's one of those people who, you know, she's got a habit because her husband's at the oil fields and she's very receptive to Walter. And, of course, for more than one reason. But it's when he's like, "Well, we can't see each other. We're going to be followed. You don't understand how Keyes works. He will catch you. You can't call me. You can't anything." Hmm. So they're completely cut off from each other. And I'm not suggesting that she was necessarily loyal to him, but she's kind of like, okay, whatever.
Yeah, whatever. And he was right about Keyes. I liked also, I mean, this movie's just a string of great scenes. But I liked when Neff was falling apart, he went in and snuck into Keyes' office and listened to him. His recording, which said, you know, "I trust Neff. I've worked for him for 11 years and I would vouch for him." And, talk about we were talking about the morality of this movie, and, you could tell he was hurt right then, you know, cause he had done it.
Right. Well, but he was also not, Keyes was also not stupid. He's like, plus he's been followed and he's completely clean.
Right, right.
Which he would have to do anyway, just to show that everybody'd been covered. But, because he was the guy who did the policy, and right after that, the insured person dies. But you get the feeling he didn't, like, you know, lay into it like he could have.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and what's so great, too, is when the policy claim first comes up, everyone believes it. The only person that's trying to refute the claim is the boss,
right?
Only because he doesn't want to pay the money out.
Right.
So he's making things up as he goes along. There must be something wrong. Oh, it's a suicide. Oh, all this stuff. Even Keyes is like, "No, it's fine. Like, you just have to pay it out."
Yeah, yeah, I agree. You know, everybody believed it. And that just makes me think, you know, wow, what a, not that it's not a racket now, but I mean the insurance business. But, immediately what they're trying to figure out is how can we not pay this?
Yeah.
That's just their normal mode.
Well, actually, it wasn't the professionals professionals weren't that way. It's just that this guy was not professional at all.
Yeah, you're right.
He's the inherited.
And he even, when Keyes started suspecting something was wrong, he even figured out, he said, unless he didn't know he had the accident claim, because it's that he broke his leg, never went in to claim his accident insurance policy.
Mm-hmm.
So unless he didn't know he had the claim. And he said, "Oh, wait, no, that can't be it, because you did it."
Yeah.
That's right. That's right.
He was totally right. It was just the fact that he trusted his friend who told him that he knew he had the claim.
Wow.
Yeah. That he, well, like he says, is, you know, you couldn't see the answer because it was as close as across your desk. And he goes, "Closer than that, Walter." He says, "I love you too, Keyes."
That final scene is so beautifully.
Oh, it's wrenching.
Yeah.
And and Edward G. Robinson lights Walter's cigarette. He always had matches. You know, or no, I guess he takes his match from him. and does it. But yeah, it's just, it's such betrayal.
But you can tell even in that betrayal, you know, his friend is dying. He still loves him.
Yeah.
He still wants him to survive. He's going to call the hospital.
Oh, yeah.
Neff says, no, what are they going to do? They're going to put me in jail, kill me.
Yeah, so I can walk into the chamber.
And actually, originally, I think they actually did film a San Quentin scene where he gets gassed.
Really?
Oh. Yeah.
Wow.
They they recreated the San Quentin gas chamber. They made trips out there and looked at it. They recreated it on the Paramount lot.
No kidding.
They wound up scrapping the ending. But somewhere apparently it got filmed. They just never used it.
Oh, about
and
that.
And I have to say, like, thank goodness.
Yeah, it was the right choice.
So powerful.
I hope it wasn't the censors that threw it out. I hope it was an artistic thing because...
No,
it just seems like it. That would have robbed it. That would have robbed it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it was an artistic thing. And because originally, so he gets gassed at San Quentin. Keyes is watching. After he dies, you see Keyes walking down the hallway. He pulls out a cigarette, starts looking for a match, and then breaks down.
Oh, no. I'm breaking down, but it would have been the wrong scene.
That's the original ending, which you could tell would have been a perfectly good ending if we didn't have this one, which is so good.
Yeah, because he can't even, and actually, now that I'm thinking about it, it's actually so perfect because Walter was always weak. He could never carry out the stuff he said he was going to do, and he cannot make it to the elevator. He cannot even get the door open.
Yeah.
That's just reflecting his inner weakness also there.
Well, he didn't even confront Keyes in person.
No.
He was going to leave it all on a dictaphone.
You're right.
That's something. And Barton Keyes was like, you're not going to get it anywhere without help.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and Neff stubbornly walks away anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that a metaphor for life?
Isn't that the truth?
Yeah. That's something else. Yeah, because, I mean, yeah, I'm really appreciating this Keyes-Neff relationship more and more as we talk about it. That really is the center of everything, like Rose said. And it's interesting that that was a decision that they made. You know, to look at a story and know that it needed that, I think that's really something.
Yeah.
You know? Because it did work. I mean, it was really something. That really worked well.
Yeah, because there's no true feeling between Phyllis and Walter. And the fact when Walter suddenly is wised up and he's saying, you never really loved me, you know. And she's like, you're right. I never did until I couldn't pull that trigger the second,
second time.
And I'm like, it took you this long to figure it out, Walter? Oh, my gosh.
He accuses her of never really loving him. He never loves her either.
No.
True.
He's using her as much as she's using him. They're just using each other for different things.
Right.
But I will say that it was pretty common for Billy Wilder to treat women worse than men. He was typically more sympathetic with his male characters' weaknesses than his female characters' weaknesses.
Hmm.
Men were more forgivable.
Well.
Wow.
That's interesting.
And that's not to say he doesn't ever provide sympathetic female characters.
Mm-hmm.
Because I'm thinking...
He has one that's insanely sympathetic with Sunset Boulevard, but...
Well, that's what I was thinking. I was like, well, everybody's fairly sympathetic in that. They're just also blind in spots.
But in this movie, they're equally weak, equally despicable, both willing to commit murder, both willing to use the people around them for their own gain. But we sympathize with Walter more in his weakness than we do with Barbara Stanwyck.
Yeah, well, you know, I think that that's right, but I'm not sure exactly why. I mean, at the very end, when she shoots him once and then can't shoot him again, you know, she's the one confessing feelings that she didn't know she had deep down. And then he shoots her twice without a thought.
He's like, I could do what you didn't,
he
baby.
Does it twice, yeah.
True, but he has that line. He gets the last, you know, where he, I don't remember exactly what she says about them both being bad. And he says, but you're a little worse.
But you're a little worse. He does say that.
Well, and I think it's because she was willing to use him without any attraction or thought of him at all. And he was willing to commit murder, but it was really to be with her. And it wasn't because of a grand passion, but at least he had a personal connection of some sort that he was doing it for her, essentially, or for them. Now, we know, watching, that they would have lasted about 10 minutes once they got that money. But until that point, he was thinking he was just doing it for her because he would never have come up with it on his own, where she was a murderer. When Lola is saying, my mother had pneumonia and I walked in on a cold night and all the windows are open and there's no covers on, and the nurse just looks at me, and that nurse was Barbara Stanwyck. Well, but she was a cold-blooded murderer.
Yeah, is he really doing it for her, though? Because you say they came up with it together, but they didn't. He said he couldn't stop thinking about it once he started. He may have gotten the idea of killing someone through and getting the insurance money from her asking about it. But he says, I couldn't stop thinking about it. He comes up with a plan, really.
That's true.
It was more because he could outsmart the system, because he could be so much cleverer than everyone around him, and he was going to do it. And she was a nice benefit.
Oh, see, I really felt like she was the goal, but he knew how to get that. He knew how to get her. That's interesting, the different points of emphasis. Hey, Fred McMurray's still a likable guy. He's just a likable, despicable, weak murderer guy.
So true.
And maybe it's also because he actually has some feeling, which it doesn't really come across very well, I think, but he really does let Lola touch his heart.
Yeah.
He does what he does for Lola because she's the one innocent person in the whole mess, and maybe he can help her. And that's, he can't bear to not to put her back in a situation where it's going to be awful for her.
Yeah,
and
he sent Nino her way.
Yeah.
Yeah, but he's also willing, up until the very end, his idea is to let Nino take the fall for him because that's Edward G. Robinson, who he thinks did it.
Mm-hmm. Right. And I'm not saying he's a great guy. I'm just saying maybe that's why we like him better than we like Barbara Stanwyck, who never makes the mistake of caring about anybody.
Oh, yeah. He's given two very sympathetic relationships.
Yeah.
Did you guys, after he killed Barbara Stanwyck and was outside the house and Nino shows up, did you think he was going to kill Nino?
Oh, no. I didn't.
I never did, actually.
I did. I thought he was going to. Yeah.
Go on a rampage kind of thing?
I guess.
It used to make sense. Kill all the witnesses.
Exactly. Well, yeah. That's what I thought he was going to have to do.
Because if he killed Nino.
Mm-hmm. You know, and then set that up somehow to try and make it look like something. But he didn't.
Or suicide.
You know, that was a surprise for me.
Had you seen this before, Scott?
Yeah, long ago.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. I wasn't sure. Yeah, and there's so many little details that even though it seems very straightforward, when you start watching it, you're just like, oh, I forgot all these things. Like, and this is just a bit of color that I really loved, but the market that they were at, that little grocery store, and it was very bustling. That was obviously a regular grocery store.
Actually, it was.
Huh?
The grocery store was a set.
Oh, okay.
But remember, I meant
it was a real,
This was during World War II, right? So there's rationing. So they actually had two cops on set because all of that was real food.
Oh,
to make
sure
that none of the cast or crew took any with them.
Holy cow.
Wow.
Although apparently there was a can of peaches and four bars of laundry soap that were stolen.
Oh.
Holy cow. No.
But yeah, there were actually cops there to make sure no one stole the food during wartime rations.
Amazing.
Well, actually, and that's really interesting. But what I was thinking, I guess, is that it was as if somebody did a set. So it's a set, but like of a Safeway or a Kroger's or a whatever. And I'm just like, that was the standard grocery store. And I'm looking at these little tiny, you know, shelves of food and how, of course, they're just showing it. Yeah, it's all so short that they can talk, whisper to each other over it, you know, pretend to look at the groceries and everything. Hey, mister, can you reach down that baby food? You know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Because they really filmed, like, that was the Glendale train station, wasn't it?
I think so.
Isn't that still there?
I mean, I've never been to it, if it is still there.
Okay. Glendale is adorable, by the way. I don't know if you've ever seen it. Scott.
No, I haven't.
We drove by.
Downtown Glendale.
During the amazingly full of stories trip, moving Rose out to California, when we were driving to that airport hotel, Rose, when we drove by this one spot, and I went, oh my gosh, this is so great. This looks like 1950s. Just moved in, and here's this little pharmacy, and here's all this stuff. And Tom, my husband, says, oh yeah, this is downtown Glendale. And I went, oh, it is? It looks like this? And he says, well, obviously carefully preserved. But I'm like, I want to live here. It's adorable.
Wow. So, that's neat.
So it's kind of, in some ways, it still looks like that. Not a lot of ways, but.
Yeah, but I live down the street from the best Ralph's ever, because it was obviously a grocery store from, you know, the 20s or 30s that they'd just redone the inside of.
Got it. Oh, how nice. Yeah, because Rose lived in Glendale until just recently, and it was the best place ever to live because, is it the Armenian mob? Keeps it nice and nice.
Well, Armenia, Little Armenia is...
That's it.
Right next to Glendale, and Glendale is heavily Armenian. And the Glendale, or the Armenian mob, operates out of Glendale. But they take all of their kills to North Hollywood. So the crime rate in Glendale is actually pretty nice.
Oh, that's funny.
You want the little lady to be able to take a walk at night, you know?
That's funny. I was once in Las Vegas. I took a cab with a guy that was working his last day. He was retiring, so he was, I don't know, 70 years old or something. And he was talking to me about how much better it was when the mob was around LA or Las Vegas. He said, you were in no danger. You know, no one could ever rob you because that person would be eliminated by the mob.
As long as you weren't on the wrong side of the mob, it was great.
So it was, he said it was great. They wanted families to be able to come here so he could come. And,
well, okay, which was funny. The priorities.
Yeah. So I love it. That's funny stuff. I love this movie. So where do I go next with Billy Wilder? I'm looking at this and trying to see if, you know... Well,
because the great thing about him is he did, like Rose was saying, he crossed genres so much that he did everything. You've seen one of my favorite comedies, Some Like It Hot, right?
Yes, I have. Yeah.
And then Sunset Boulevard. Oh my gosh, that's great. It was really a coin toss whether it was going to be that or Double Indemnity, because it is. In a different way, but very similarly in that noir style way, but it is so amazing. And it's a movie that took Hollywood and poked it right in the eye.
Really?
They were
one
so
of the first really scathing looks at Hollywood.
With a lot of Hollywood personalities at the time participating in the movie. And some people wouldn't, because they knew Hollywood studios were going to be so mad. But like Cecil B. DeMille is in the movie as himself.
Hmm.
I think Buster Keaton, some people like that.
Oh, interesting.
One of the old film stars.
Yeah.
Silent
film stars.
Well, you know all that stuff that went on in the 50s with, you know, trying to figure out who's a communist and who isn't. Was Wilder caught up in that stuff too?
No.
Okay. Interesting.
He wasn't super political.
Uh-huh.
So
they were okay with the censors, him poking the censors, but if you were a communist, it was not okay.
Yeah.
We have national security to worry about.
Exactly.
He also did The Apartment.
The Apartment, yep. I see it right here. I'm looking at IMDb.
Which I've never seen. Famous comedies. He did a lot. He liked Jack Lemmon a lot. He liked working with Jack Lemmon.
Great performances.
Yeah, Jack Lemmon, Shirley MacLaine, and Fred McMurray.
Oh, okay, Fred McMurray again. I guess I should watch The Apartment. I think I tried it once, but it was so long ago, and I was like, this isn't as side-splitting as I expected. It seems to be a bit more biting, and I don't want that.
It is. He did The 7-Year Itch, which has Marilyn Monroe. Mm-hmm. You know the famous shot of her standing above the subway grate?
Yeah.
Right.
That's that movie, The 7-Year Itch. He often said he should have won an award just as the only director to ever work with Marilyn Monroe twice.
Oh, my gosh.
She was very difficult.
Was she?
Someday we'll do some Like It Hot. We'll get Rose back on to tell us the many, many Marilyn Monroe stories.
Oh, I'd love that.
Oh, my gosh.
That would be
great.
But
when she was on, there was nobody better. No one the camera loved more. Who could not love Marilyn Monroe?
Mm-hmm.
Had to. But he did Stalag 17, which is a great prisoner of war movie, you know, camp movie.
Yeah.
He did Sabrina.
Sabrina, yeah. That was remade with Harrison Ford, right? I think I've seen the remake.
Yes.
Yeah. Ooh, Bogart. Humphrey Bogart, Audrey Hepburn. Oh, wow. Why did they remake
it? And was it William or was it the Sunset Boulevard guy? Was the younger brother in that? Wasn't he? Holden?
I need to look it back up here. William Holden.
William Holden? Yep.
Bogart, Hepburn, and Holden in Sabrina. Mm-hmm.
He did The Lost Weekend. Which is famous also, although, you know, very depressing since it's about an alcoholic.
Mm-hmm.
Ray Milland.
So really, pretty much everything he's directed. What about The Major and the Minor, which was...
That was his first movie. The first one he directed. It is, I think, a very good... It actually did very well in theaters.
Uh-huh.
And I think it's a really good example of screwball comedies of the time, which means it's pretty amusing. You like the main characters. Would it ever work in real life? No. Mm-hmm. No one's ever going to believe that Ginger Rogers is a 12-year-old.
Yeah.
She's trying to get the lower fare rate. She can't afford an adult ticket on a train.
Uh-huh.
So she dresses up as a 12-year-old.
Huh.
That's the big conceit, is you have to believe that Ginger Rogers can pass as a 12-year-old.
Nice.
And then there's a kindly attractive man of the age she should be dating who's defending her and helping her get along through all her screwball situations because she's only 12.
Because she winds up at a military academy full, of course, of 12-year-old boys.
Yes.
We're all very interested in Ginger Rogers.
Isn't there some old man who I'll help you get home or I'll, you know, that kind of thing.
It's been so long since I've seen it.
I just remember Rose recommending that and me watching it going, I cannot suspend this belief, disbelief long enough. I'll watch it. But it was interesting to think of Billy Wilder directing Ginger Rogers in this movie.
He actually, did a lot of the movies he wrote in Berlin were musicals.
Really?
Yeah, and it wasn't a genre he especially liked, but it was a lot of the work he got. So that was a lot of his early experience.
Well, and he did, even if he wasn't the sole writer usually, he always had a hand in the screenplay. If you look at his movies... He almost always is.
He couldn't write by himself.
Right, but he could fix up or, you know, interject enough that he was always key to it, I think.
I think he just needed someone to bounce ideas off of.
Mm-hmm.
And he actually worked predominantly with Charles Brackett, and then after that it was IAL Diamond, I think. And he rarely wrote with anyone else. But he also wrote a movie that isn't as famous as some of his other ones, but which is really good, called Ace in the Hole.
I was just going to mention that. Oh, my gosh.
Ace in the Hole.
It's Kirk Douglas. And you know what? That one works just as well, if not better, today. It's amazing how well that movie applies to today.
About journalism and the lengths journalists will go to create a story.
Shock journalism. And also the American willingness to just swallow any emergency and their eagerness for the story, not ever giving the journalists a reason to stop.
Wow.
I mean, it's an indictment, and it's powerful. I mean, Rose told us about it. We watched it and just went, why does not everyone know of this movie? It is amazing.
Cool.
I was just thinking of it the other day in the ending of it, which I won't talk about.
You two have named at least half of his films. It says he's directed 27 of them.
And a lot of his later ones aren't as good.
Mm-hmm.
But he's got a lot of really great films. And even the ones that aren't as good as his best known ones are still pretty good.
What about one called 1, 2, 3? Have you heard of that? Someone mentioned that to me the other day.
Was it Jack Lemmon? Let's see. I think it was the other guy.
James Cagney, Horst Buchholz.
Oh,
isn't that Magnificent Seven?
Yes, yeah, it is. Yes.
There's the other movie he was in.
Oh my gosh.
Oh wow, everything's connected.
It's coming together, man. Well, in fact, that's one that one of the people at Carruth Haven, one of the older ladies, had said, oh, if somebody was saying they had never seen any Jimmy Cagney movies, and she goes, oh, we should watch 1, 2, 3. That's really an excellent movie.
Hmm.
We haven't gotten around to it yet, but that's why.
It says it's a comedy about Coca-Cola's man in West Berlin who may be fired if he can't keep his American boss's daughter from marrying a communist. It's a comedy.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I should mention, actually, that while he didn't direct this, he co-wrote Ninotchka.
Oh, that was the other one. That was one of his early ones.
It was when he was still a screenwriter, and it was directed by Ernest Lubitsch. Who was one of his idols.
Well, and deservedly so. Oh, my gosh. Well, you know, he did, Scott, the Jack Benny movie that we watched.
To Be or Not to Be.
Yeah.
Yeah, which did not do very well at the time.
No, but it's one of those classics that grew as time, or, you know, grew into a classic later. But,
supports Lubitsch said, it doesn't matter if the audience thinks it's funny. If it's funny, you should keep it. And that's a movie that he was proven right about, because the audience did not think that was funny,
right.
But it is funny, and he kept it in there.
Yeah.
And time has proven him correct.
Yeah. And he's another one. If you start looking through his list of movies, you may not know a lot of them, but he did a zillion movies. And every so often, my husband also really likes his movies, and we'll go through and we'll just go, oh, look, Ernest Lubitsch, and we'll get it. And it's, as Rose was saying about Billy Wilder, it might not be one of his better known or even one of his best, but there's always something good in there that you can enjoy one way or the other. So I guess Billy Wilder did his idol, you know, good credit.
Mm-hmm.
And speaking of that chain of people who influence you, I heard Ron Howard talking on something and about getting the kind of movies he chose, and how about partway through his career, he changed the sort of movies he was doing. And he said, you know, I was always doing movies that I thought the audiences would like, and I started doing movies that I thought I would like. And for me, they have been much more hit or miss. But his influence in that was Billy Wilder, because he loved his movies. And then he stopped one time and looked at all the movies he did. And he said, well, he did, as you said, you know, 23 movies. And he goes, were they all hits? No, but he liked doing them. And that was the point.
Interesting.
Oh,
that's
he also
neat.
Did Witness for the Prosecution.
Oh my gosh, yes.
Which is great. That's got Marlene Dietrich.
Montgomery Clift, who is one of my favorites. He was an amazing actor.
Yeah. Wilder was actually friends with Marlene Dietrich when they were both in Berlin.
Oh, I think I remember hearing that. Yeah, it was an interesting role for her. And it's an Agatha Christie play, by the way.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. Well, my list overfloweth.
I know. I guess we should stop talking about this because we can go on for way too long.
You can just see everything. He's
just
fun.
Watch everything.
It's fine. Yeah. Recommend everything.
All right.
Yeah.
Will do.
Yeah.
Will do.
And I do want to say also that if you want to read a book about him that's really well written and has a lot of great information, there's a book called On Sunset Boulevard that's by a guy named Ed Sickop.
Okay. Cool. Got it. Well, great. This was a heck of a lot of fun. Thanks, Rose, for being here. I mean, that was awesome. I learned a lot.
How could I turn down Billy Wilder?
I knew I Absolutely. Had the right hook to That's pull her right. in.
well done. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So, Julie, what have we got coming up now?
Oh, my gosh.
Let's see.
One of the best books no one's ever heard of, although everybody
heard
of it.
Oh, yeah.
That's right. Mockingbird by Walter Tevis.
That's right.
Yes.
Yep.
And then Scott?
Yes, we're going to do Life Itself, documentary about Roger Ebert.
Right.
Yep.
Have you seen that, Rose?
I have not.
Okay. I was just curious.
Mm-hmm. I enjoyed
it. I'll have to check it out now.
I enjoyed it a lot. You know, it's really an excuse to talk about Roger Ebert, but I like the movie quite a bit. So that's great. And then we'll talk about
him is good.
Yeah,
Sorry.
Yeah, we haven't talked. Well, his name comes up, but it'll be fun to talk to him.
Yeah.
Talk about him, that is. The Caine Mutiny by Herman Woke.
Mm-hmm.
The book, not the film. So Humphrey Bogart was in that, I think.
Yes.
But yeah, great book. I hope you enjoy it.
I think I read it a long time. You know, back in the days before they had streaming everything, and one of the local museums actually had this retrospective series where we went down once a week and watched some old movie starring Humphrey Bogart for about like 2 months.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I think, was the first movie I'd ever seen with him in it, other than his really early ones where he'd be like the gangsters heavy, where he played an unsympathetic character.
Hmm.
It was, I realize that's not the book, but it made me read the book, which I remember liking. I don't remember much about it, though.
Well, good.
Yeah.
Cool. We'll have lots to talk about in that. Guaranteed.
Mm-hmm.
Guaranteed. That brings us into, at the end of July. So that'll hold us for a while.
Yep.
Okay.
Just holding back from putting my next choices in there. So
you're like, I think I know what I'm going to do. So,
I can't help it.
This will be fun.
I like to make lists, you know.
You bet. All right. Well, thanks for listening, everybody.
Yes, thank you for this long one.
You bet. We'll see you next time.
Yeah, we'll talk to you again soon.
Okay, bye-bye. Thank you.